There is no more demanding or frustrating profession than that of teaching. The spaced out student may be a unique creature of our times, but the tuned out student has been known to teachers since time immemorial. The first pedagogue whom we know by name in our own tradition was the master of a school in Jerusalem. We call today a private school. It was a school which was run for the sons of the best families of Jerusalem around the year 200 before the Common Era by a man named Joshua ben Sirach. And towards the end of his life, this schoolmaster put down on parchment the wisdom which he had tried to dispense to his students over time, that they might reflect on it and remind their children and their grandchildren of it. And that book has survived. It's called Ecclesiasticus, or the Wisdom of Ben Sirach. And in it, among many other things, we can find all of the anxiety and the frustration of any teacher. Ben Sirach wrote, "He who teaches the tuned out," I use the modern phrase, the Bible uses the word kasil, a fool, someone who does not understand the value of learning. "He who teaches the tuned out is like one who tries to piece together a broken clay pot, or as one who tries to wake up a heavy sleeper from deep slumber. One who tells a story to such a student tells it to one who is drowsing off. At the end of it, he will say, 'What were you talking about?'" And none of us are ever satisfied with our schools. There's been a crisis in the classroom every 3 or 4 years in recent American history. Every time some event shakes us temporarily out of our smugness and complacency as in America, we find a reason to be dissatisfied with our schools. When Sputnik went up, when the Russians seemed to have a great advantage over us in the technology of space and of war, we suddenly demanded that our schools intensify and strengthen their teaching in sciences and in mathematics. When there was the contretemps Selma, we suddenly insisted that our schools and the classrooms be crucibles of integration, that they solve all the problems of racial justice in society. As the so-called new morality spread its shadow over the land, we insisted that our schools be centers of sex education and drug education. When we saw Roots, we began to think in terms of our ethnic background and its identification. We thought we demanded the schools become bilingual, that they teach students in the language of their background rather as well as in English. And as we've gone in these last years into a conservative mood, we've insisted that our schools go back to what are called the basics, and that they become places where the old-fashioned virtues, including prayer in the schools, evangelist ideas, creationism, all these be part somehow or other of the school program. Now, I suspect that when the history of education in America is written in some future date, someone will remark on the inconsistent and even contradictory pressures which our society has placed upon the schools. And our schools are particularly vulnerable. They depend upon a local tax base, and they are therefore necessarily responsive to the whims of the moment in a particular community or a social class. And trying to respond to all of the pressures that have been put upon them in recent decades, trying to make up, in a sense, for the disintegration of the American home, for the disintegration of a sense of common purpose in our society, our schools increasingly turn their attention to other things besides what is, after all, the basic purpose of a school system, to equip young people with the verbal and computational skills required to live with any degree of success in our society, which our society requires. to be able to equip itself for life and for productive existence in the 21st century. Now, those of us who have been teaching in recent years at the college level know that the failures of our school system are not limited to the dropouts from high school in our center cities, and that the failures of the college system are not limited to the black athletes who are training there for professional sports, and it's whom the colleges are willing to pass along without any thought to whether they can write the English language or even understand it. Each one of us has his own set of horror stories. My own include the senior student at Case Western Reserve University who took a class in religion with me, who wrote her term paper on the prophets of Israel, and every time that the prophets appeared in that paper, it was spelled P-R-O-F-I-T-S. I had a freshman class at Case Western Reserve in the Bible some years ago where literally a third of the class did not know the difference between AD and BC, much less between BCE and CE. Now, many complain that professors at the universities have gone to multiple choice questions rather than the long, old-fashioned essays out of laziness, out of their unwillingness to grade these more complicated papers. That may be part of the reason, but a major part of the reason is that you're sick at heart as you read the stumbling attempts of so-called bright American college students to express a simple thought in English. I once counted on a six-page final examination, I was being perverse at the moment, I once counted 168 errors of spelling and syntax and grammar. This by a college junior who was at one of the better universities in the United States and presumably had control of the English language. And when we feel somehow that it may be us, that we our standards are too high, that we may have had a particularly weak class, we've only to look at the increasing proportion of high school graduates who have to take remedial English and remedial mathematics at the college level to know that the fault is only ours, or that we haven't had an unfortunate selection of students in our classes. Unfortunately, Americans are not serious about education. Education is still a part-time activity in the United States. The average student in our elementary and secondary schools is out of school more days each year than they're in school. And interestingly, when one compares this, let's say, to Japan, we find that the Japanese student begins school a year earlier, 4 rather than 5, that the average Japanese student is in classes for 40 to 50 more days a year than the average American student, so that by the time that student graduates from high school, and 97% of their student body graduates from high school, they have had 4 extra years of classroom experience beyond what our own students here in America have had. And if you want to know where the Japanese economic miracle begins, why they're more successful in so many areas than we are, it begins in the classroom. It begins in the commitment to education of that society which ours cannot begin to match. And because our educational system in America has been really a part-time system, still in the horse and buggy age, after all, why do we have these long summer vacations? Because it's 150 years ago the children were needed on the farm. And we haven't literally changed our attitudes towards the school year at any time since. Why not? Because it would increase the taxes we have to pay. We've wanted education on the cheap. And as a result, education, the educational system has suffered up and down the line. For as long as women were not liberated, that is, for as long as education, elementary and secondary education, were one of the few areas in which bright, energetic, and talented women were allowed to express themselves professionally, by and large, the level of teacher competence in America remained fairly high. But the minute that women were allowed into the other areas of the professional world, the level of the teaching of our teaching faculty fell dramatically. And over the past 30 to 40 years, the average teacher in the average school has come from the bottom quarter of the college classes in second, third, and fourth rate colleges in the United States. We're not teaching our youngsters with the best and the brightest. We're teaching youngsters with some of the weakest and the least able of all of our people. I remember going some years ago to a parents' night, my fifth grader. It was one of the so-called fine private schools in Cleveland. The teacher had written on the board a short agenda for that evening. And as I looked over the agenda, I noticed that there were two spelling mistakes and three grammatical mistakes. Well, those who don't know can't teach. And I'm afraid that there are many in the classroom whose command of English, whose command of their subject matter, is minimal, to say the least. And until we determine that education is a priority, and Americans tend to judge the value of any enterprise by its cost, that is, until we are willing to invest significant amount of our capital, of our gross national project in the educational system, to raise the salaries and the status of teachers to the level where the best and the brightest will be attracted to the field and create the conditions which will allow them to remain with dignity in the field, we will continue to have classrooms where the blind are leading the deaf, where the least able are misleading some of our most able and are failing entirely to reach those whom they ought to with the intellectual disciplines which we ought to be conveying. Now, all of this, of course, is a result of what can only be called a prevailing anti-intellectualism in the American society. America was founded by those who fled from the cultured urban areas of Europe. We've always felt that a broad back and a willing spirit and a pragmatic capacity to fix things up, to tinker, would somehow get us through. And with the exception of, I think, our own ethnic religious group, the Jews, almost none of the groups that came to these shores until the middle of this century brought with them a reverence for scholarship, a feeling that associated learning with social status, capacity. And as a result, not great efforts were placed by most of our people upon the quality of education. And I'm afraid that that condition remains, and it has infected even our own Jewish community. When I used to look 30 years ago at the annual list of National Merit Scholars, it read like the membership list of the local synagogue. Today, we're not overrepresented. And when I'm told that when the president of Harvard, Derek Bok, was commenting recently to someone, some group, on what's happened with the applications for admission to Harvard, he observed that those who come out of Oriental homes are the Jews of this generation. And I'm not surprised, and you shouldn't be either. The drive which our parents communicated to us, most of us of our generation, the feeling that they knew what was good for us, music lessons, Hebrew lessons, French lessons, not skiing lessons, swimming lessons, and soccer lessons. The feeling that when we came home from school and we had a report card with four A's and a B, the first question would be, why the B? That kind of pressure no longer exists in most of our homes. People are eager for their children to be well-rounded. And one of the pressures against the year-round school system is that one of the ways in which we prepare them for a country club existence is to send them to country club camps. And if we couldn't send them to summer camps, they wouldn't have the skills necessary for leisure time activities later on in their lives. But unfortunately, a world of 4.5 billion earthlings is not going to reward mediocrity. And those whose skills are mediocre at best, who have not taken advantage of the learning opportunities that are provided them, will quickly find that they cannot provide for themselves and their children what those who were pushed and shaped and shoved and which high academic standards were demanded have been able to provide for theirs. We forget in our comfort, in our desire for our children to be happy, that education is not designed to be a fun experience. It's designed to be a learning experience. That learning is a discipline. That like all disciplines, it requires concentration, it requires mental effort. Inevitably, there are frustrations in learning anything. And then until you're willing to persevere, to do the homework, to work at it, you will not break through to the level of competence in a particular field or particular subject. One of the tragedies of American life is that this society, being a free, democratic society, depends upon the knowledge and the skills of the large middle class, the large middle group of intelligence. And though we're told by those who study these things that by the time they reach graduate school, the 10% of our best and brightest are fully the equal of the best and brightest any place in the world, they also tell us that the great American middle is slipping further and further behind the academic accomplishments of the rest of at least the industrialized world. Let's take Japan. Japan is a country whose competitive capacity we've all become aware of. To a certain degree, its achievements have mesmerized the American community. Now, the problem with Japanese competition is not that they have been flooding the American market with cheap, mass-produced, shoddy goods. The reason that they're such successful competitors is that they're able to flood the American market with better designed, better engineered, and cheaper goods than we can produce. Now, why so? Well, I've already suggested to you that the average Japanese student, before he or she enters college, has been in classroom for 4 years more than the average American student. Between grade 7 and 12, the average Japanese student has spent 6 years learning a foreign language. Between the grade 7 and 12, the average American student has spent 1 year learning a foreign language. In their high school years, Japanese students are required to take 4 years of mathematics and 3 years of advanced science. In most American communities, the average American high school student takes 2 years of mathematics and 1 year of a science. And if you want to know why there is a more effective, more efficient workforce in Japan, it begins in the classroom. It begins in the disciplines of learning. They are simply more skilled than our youngsters, in fact, are. And the issue really boils down to one of motivation. I'm not suggesting that we want to transfer to America the motivational structure of Japan. The Japanese motivational structure is based upon family pressure and competition. There are tests which one must pass every step of the way. One must pass a test between elementary school and high school to get into the best academic high schools. One must pass a test after high school to get into the best colleges. There's developed in Japan a group they call Ronin, which is the old word for those who were wandering warriors, sort of rootless warriors. High school graduates with fine academic records who want to get into Tokyo University or the Harvard or Yale of Japan were not able to do so at the first crack until they spend a year or two cramming for the entrance examinations and take them over and over again until those doors are opened to them. Now, I'm not suggesting that we ought to take over whole the competitive system which almost every other country of the world has. In England, there are O-level examinations and A-level examinations. In almost every system, there's a way of building into the system the recognition that unless you achieve to the utmost, you'll not move on to the next step, and that ultimately those who go through the various steps and get to the best universities and get the best education are those who can look forward to the future with some degree of assurance and some degree of promise. In America, the reverse really takes place. What's the most important thing in high school? sports, and social life. In America, we have to prove to each individual student the value of taking each individual course that the youngster happens to take. I don't know if you came across, as I did yesterday in the Plain View, a snippet of an article which in a sense captures some of our concerns. It comes from Fort Worth, Texas. It says that a 17-year-old high school student reported he paid a math teacher $75 for an A because it meant a chance to get out of school an hour early and no more worries about the subject. Quote, "I'm not really crazy about geometry. I didn't see how it would help me in any way later on," said Steve Moore. "I wouldn't have done it if I didn't think I could get away with it." He saw no value in what he was learning because there's nothing in the context of his life which suggests the ultimate value of education. And in fact, the schools know what they're doing. And he felt he could bribe a teacher, and the teacher was bribable. Automatic promotions, grade inflation. Why not? It's the easiest way to get tax levies passed. You don't put demands upon students. What's been the greatest issue in the state of Texas? Not the economic problems having to do with the failures in the oil fields, but that the state legislature had the temerity this last year to say that no one could participate in high school athletics unless they at least had a D average on their report card. Not a C double minus, but a D average. And the state is up in arms. What's important? High school football, high school baseball, high school track. What's unimportant? A's, academic achievement. And if you want to know why the great American middle is faltering, if you want to cry for our country, cry about its lack of intellectual and educational concern. Because a country which depends upon 10% of its best and brightest to carry it along, to be inventive, creative, administrative, to have all the capacities which will bring us into, which will maintain our prosperity, is betting on a gamble which cannot pay off. We need to develop to the full, in our overcrowded and competitive world, all of the skills which we possibly can. Take each mind, each God-given mind, and develop it as completely as we can. But that's not the American way. The American way is to be satisfied with being well-rounded, to feel that our youngsters should have a happy time as they grow up. It's to feel that somehow all will work out. Why? Because it has always worked out. Why has it always worked out? Because we had a vast land expanse, because we had great natural resources, and because we were in a pre-industrial, early industrial society. But I assure you that this high age of high technology, of complicated politics and complicated economics, we will not survive if our youngsters can't add and subtract, multiply and divide, spell, write in English sentences, or explain themselves. I appreciate and I approve of the Back to Basics movement, but I would suggest to you that it's hardly what is needed. Most of our youngsters today need that high level of skills in all areas which will allow them twice or maybe three times in their adult life to change fields. So quickly does the market change, so quickly do the demands placed upon us change. And if they don't have these skills, they're going to fall behind. It's a tragedy, isn't it, when study after study reports that a significant majority of high school seniors could not identify the senators of their state, or could not tell you what the Strategic Defense Initiative is all about? How can we talk of having an educated electorate when the level of knowledge, of information about the major issues of the day is minimal to non-existent? And they're not going to get it from the mass media. You can't get real knowledge of what is happening from television news. You get a picture, an impression, but not the news, not the background. And you won't get it from the Cleveland Plain Dealer. And the elite, the 10%, read the thoughtful magazines, they read the New York Times, the Washington Post, or the Wall Street Journal. But the 90% read the sports, They read the society, they read the cooking pages, if they can read, but not much else. And that's the society, the level of competence with which we as a nation believe we can compete with the rest of the world in the 21st century. And I would say to you categorically, but we can't. Is education worth it? It's obviously worth it. But before we can have a meaningful educational system in the United States, we must be committed, we must have the wisdom to be committed to the value of education. Which means that we must not only be committed to the importance of gaining the tools with which we ply a trade, but we must have the intelligence to be committed to wisdom for its own sake, to information for its own purposes, to a breadth of knowledge, because that's what a free society requires of its citizens. And that means that we have to begin to make demands of our children, and we have to be able to willing to say to them, the schools, the community, your family knows best. Why should a 17-year-old be prepared, be able to say to us, I know the geometry won't do me any good, therefore I'll spend $75 and pass the course? Why should we have to defend every class that we offer to the young people? The school system should be defensible in and of itself. This is the way one prepares oneself for life in our day and in the future. And that's defense enough. And the motivation must begin in the home. But unfortunately, there are fewer and fewer homes and fewer motivated homes. And it must begin in a commitment by the adults to the value of learning. And I must confess that even among we Jews who pride ourselves so much upon learning and having this tradition, I go into home after home where I can't find a book, where what's on is a television set. And I'm troubled. Years ago, when the Hebrew University was simply a dream of Judah Leon Magnus, who became its first president, he wrote to a number of leading Jewish thinkers of the time asking for their ideas. Nachman Am, the great essayist, wrote back to Magnus, this is about 1910, 1912, and he said to him, learning, 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 that is the key to Jewish survival. And to a very large degree, I'm convinced he's right. And I'm convinced one could say the same thing about the survival of our own society. Learning, learning, learning is the key, the secret of American survival. But it will not come easily. And we cannot buy it simply by buying buildings. In the 1960s, you'll recall that James Coleman made his famous study of the educational structure of the United States. And one of the major findings of that study was that it didn't matter whether the students were in a fine building such as this, or rather dilapidated structure, whether a library had 10,000 volumes or 5,000 volumes, whether there were new desks or older desks, whether the ratio of students to teachers was 25 to 1 or 30 to 1, that none of these things really had a significant impact on educational accomplishment. What had the impact? Family pressures and interests, peer pressures and interests. Those were the two controlling factors. And study after study since that time has confirmed this observation. Just 2 years ago in England, a sociologist by the name of Michael Rutter studied the common schools in England, the non-private schools of England. He tried to find out why it was that some schools seemed to be doing a better job than others. And his conclusion was that those schools were most effective in which there was a clear pattern of discipline, in which it was clear to everybody in the school that school felt it knew what it was doing, in which there was a pattern in the school of control of the faculty so that weaker teachers, indifferent teachers, were let go and a stronger faculty was built year in and year out, in which there was a system of rewards built in for those students who achieved academically, and that those rewards were superior in the eyes of the school to the rewards which were given to students for any other extracurricular activity. And in a very real sense, if we think of that, the effective school is not unlike the effective home. Consistent discipline, a sense of purpose, reward for significant achievement, These are the hallmarks of the effective home as well as of the effective school. And if our schools are ineffective, the answer lies in the fact that we simply as a society have not yet determined that we are willing to think of learning as the quintessential responsibility of the social order. And until we do, the level of accomplishment by the 90% in America will drop further and further against the accomplishment of the middle in England, and the middle in France, and the middle in Scandinavia, and a large percentage of the students in Japan. And more we'll find ourselves unable to compete. More and more we'll find children who are dead-ended, who lack the functional skills to manage in our society. More and more frustration will be built in our society. More and more people will turn to men on white horses in order to lead them to a promised land, the land their parents promised them, but they're not able to reach on their own. And more we will find our society being distorted, something other than that which we hoped it to be. Learning, learning, learning. That's the secret, and there is no other. Amen.